Hello, everybody. This is Joseph Patrich, the director of the Wirth Institute for Austrian and Central European Studies. And I'm happy to be back with you to talk again about some various themes exploring Central European history. Today, my talk is titled, Marie Antoinette Was Not Alone, Medieval and Early Modern Habsburg Marriage Diplomacy, The Women Who Left Home. Before I start, I would like to say I hope everybody's well. My family and I just got back from a few days up in the national parks here in Canada, up in the mountains. I was looking a little bit into where some of the internment camps were during the First World War, where Austro-Hungarians were interned, and I think I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few weeks when I have a whole podcast dedicated to the internment of Austro-Hungarians by the Canadians during the First World War. But that's not today. Today is marriage diplomacy and the Habsburgs. Those of you who've been following closely along at home in these previous two podcasts might have noticed that the Habsburg family really got going in the early modern, late medieval period. They started out as this modest dynasty that I talked about a couple weeks ago with their holdings in the Upper Rhine Valley and Alsace and places like Switzerland that are now Switzerland. But if you were listening carefully at the last lecture on the Little Ice Age, you heard me talk about how suddenly by then they were having big diplomatic congresses in Vienna and they were organizing connections with Hungary and with Bohemia. They were expanding dramatically their sphere of influence. You may recall that the Duke Rudolf of Habsburg was active in the 13th century, acquiring the Austrian holdings along the Danube around Vienna in those areas. I talked a little bit about how the Habsburgs acquired some of those Central European territories, which were so well placed to take advantage of the changes in the economy of Europe following the so-called Black Death, the pandemic of the 14th century. But I didn't really explain much about how they managed to catapult themselves onto the big screen again, the big scene up into the imperial level that they were at by the 16th century when I was talking about the Little Ice Age. Some of it was done with military. I think actually people often underestimate the military role of the Habsburgs, their successes. But a lot of it was done through diplomacy, particularly through marriages. In fact, as a Habsburg specialist, if I tell people I study and teach about this family, the two things that people seem to know about the Habsburgs are that they had a distinctive jaw. So everybody says, oh, that's that family with the jaw. And they may also know that this family is famous for marrying. There's a famous saying that goes along with the Habsburg family, let others fight, you happy Austria marry. If I've heard that once, I've heard it 1,000 times when I tell people I'm a specialist or I teach about this topic. The motto itself goes on to say, for those things which Mars gives to others, the goddess Venus gives to you. And apparently, it was actually a bit of an insult in the early 16th century or mid-16th century when it was first coined. Some of the Frenchmen who coined it apparently were making fun of the Habsburgs, saying, oh, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're not fighting to get power. You're marrying to get power. And to some extent, that's true. The way the Habsburgs managed to get power was not just on the battlefield, but through a series of very complicated diplomatic arrangements and also through a lot of luck, I would say, particularly in the period between approximately 1477 and, let's say, 1519, or maybe, it's just in those decades, things broke their way because of the various marriages that they had arranged. When people think of the Habsburgs, though, or when they think of the marriage diplomacy, they normally think of the people that married into the family, the women who married into the family and brought big inheritances and connections into the family, helping the family expand its influence to become the European and world power that family became by 1600. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about another topic, and not so much the women who married in, though I'll say a few things about some of the women who married into the family, but I want to talk more about the women who married out, the ones who left the house to go abroad. I wrote a chapter in a collection on this topic, and if you'd like to know more, it's called Leaving Home for the Sake of the House, and it's in a collection called Early Modern Habsburg Women, Transnational Context, Cultural Conflicts, Dynastic Continuities, edited by Anne Cruz and Maria Galli Stampino. I'll put a link, or we'll put a link on the website of the Wirth Institute about this and some other references for you. But in that article, that chapter, I spent some time analyzing who it was that the Habsburgs were marrying outside of the family, not just the ones, again, who married in. It's a little bit complicated to follow the trail sometimes of the women who leave the house, because they are often then connected more with the family into which they marry, right? It's a kind of a standard question. When a woman marries, does she connect up more with her parents' family, stay connected with the parents' family, or with the family of her husband? And these Habsburg women often had to face that same challenge. Do they connect up and stay connected with their Habsburg relatives at home, or do they connect up more with the family into which they marry when they go abroad? I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but the Habsburg dynasty was successful over many centuries, partly because of their ability somehow to convince the women who married into the family that it was important for them, these women, to support their children and not so much their fathers or brothers or sisters or mothers. This is a story we can't get into with too much detail here, but I would like to make a plug for a course I'll be teaching in fall of next year called Empresses, Queens, and Archduchesses, Women of the Habsburg Dynasty, and I'll be teaching that here at the University of Alberta. That will give me the opportunity to go much more into detail and depth about a large number of these women of the dynasty. You may recall also, I think I mentioned this in an earlier podcast, that I wrote a book about one of these women who left, though, of course, that book stops right at the time when she leaves to become Queen of France. And this talk today is titled partly in reference to her descendant, Maria Antonia, who is another one of these Habsburg women, probably the most famous of the Habsburg women who leave home and go abroad. Maria Antonia, better known by her French name, Marie Antoinette, who goes to become the Queen of France in the 18th century. And you may already know that doesn't end well, either for her or for her husband. There's been a lot of research recently, and a lot more research, I would say, recently on Habsburg women, or I guess women in rule in general. And if you'd like to know more about some of the themes of today's talk, I also would recommend that you go to the website that I'll link to on the website of the Institute, which is connected to a research project at the Austrian Academy of Sciences. It deals particularly with empresses, which is a theme I'm interested in and I'll talk about today. It's a particular research project, mostly dealing with the empresses, I think, of the 17th century. We had actually a visitor from this research project, Dr. Marian Romberg, here at the University of Alberta just last winter, and she gave a couple public talks and did some research here in our special collections. She gave a talk about her research on the Empress Eleonora Magdalena, who was the empress in the late 17th, early 18th century. When you think about queens or empresses or archduchesses, women in rule in the early modern period, I think you have to think about or keep in mind some terminology. And I want to start today or continue today with discussing just a few terms so that we're clear when I talk about some of these women, what their roles in their various political situations exactly were. To be a ruler in early modern society or a woman in rule, you had I would say, four different possible roles you could play. You could be, say, a queen regnant. That is, you could rule in your own name, ruling regnant, a regnant queen, or archduchess, or whatever your title might be. You could be a consort. That is, the spouse of a ruling king or emperor or archduke or whatever title. You could be potentially a regent, say a queen regent, ruling in someone else's name. And of course, you could be a dowager, that is, a queen or empress dowager, somebody whose husband had passed away but is still influential, living off of incomes normally promised in a marriage contract. These are particularly powerful behind-the-scenes women with lots of patronage rights. Their role in society is often overlooked, but I think a lot more research could be done on the various dowagers. Of course, if you think about early modern society, you have to realize that not every place is the same. Not every country was the same. So it's not one size fits all. You have to remember that the legal situation varies for women across Europe. And of course, we can't go into that in too much detail here. But for the empresses, for example, you can't have or never had an empress regnant in the early modern period. An empress could only become, woman could only become an empress either through marrying an emperor or having her husband become emperor. The imperial title in the early modern period is an elective title. There's only, what, 7 to 9 men who have the right to select an emperor, so it's elective, and they never elected a woman. So the only way a woman can be empress, again, is through marriage. So you can't, therefore, have a regnant empress. You can only have a regnant emperor. You can have an empress consort. Of course, you're married to the emperor. But you also can't have an empress regent. There were no empresses ruling in the name of an emperor or a son. These are people who are ruling in the name of someone else. But in the imperial system of the Holy Roman Empire, as soon as an emperor died, there would be a process to elect his successor, if that successor hadn't already been designated in an earlier election. So there's no role for a regent. This is different than in the some of the other kingdoms of England, of Europe, the Spanish kingdoms, the British kingdoms, of course, the French kingdom. Many of these kingdoms had the right for female inheritance, or at least women could play a role as queen's regent. And some of the Habsburgs who married abroad actually became queen's regent in the territories into which they married. Here in Canada, of course, we have a queen regnant. There is a queen on the throne. The British tradition is that women can inherit. And so here we have a ruler from the House of Windsor serving as the head of state of Canada. But the Habsburgs, in many of their territories associated particularly with the Holy Roman Empire, didn't have that right. The women didn't have that right. So actually marrying out of the house gave them the opportunity, perhaps, to have power and influence, which they couldn't have had if they'd stayed home or if they were married into the Holy Roman Empire or into some of the territories to which they were more closely connected. So it depends on whether the kingdom is an elective kingdom or a hereditary kingdom and the rights of women in those particular places. When you think of women in the early modern period and political role, remember they could play many different roles. They could be many different positions, sisters, nieces, cousins, wives, mothers, grandmothers, on and on it goes. What I wanted to do when I was looking at the research or thinking about these women who went abroad is try to understand the history of the Habsburg dynasty by seeing at what level the women were able to marry who left the home. And I looked at 66 women over the course of about 500 years from the 1270s to the 1770s, and tried to examine who these Habsburg women then married and where they married. And my argument is, my belief is, that you can understand the position of the dynasty in European history, especially in the later Middle Ages and early modern period, by looking at the level at which the women who leave the Habsburg home marry. Do they marry at the same level? Do they marry kings? Do they marry princes of various levels? Who do they marry? Or are they marrying dukes? Are they marrying counts? Where on the social hierarchy, the political hierarchy, do they marry? And you can get a sense of the relative power of the dynasty by looking at the position of the men to whom the Habsburg women marry. Also, you can get a sense of the geographic distribution of power and where their power is organized. Who is interested in marrying to the Habsburgs, marrying a Habsburg daughter? Is it somebody from far away? Is it somebody from close? Is their power base localized in a certain region? Is their power base farther? You'd have to probably map this to get a real sense of it. We can't do it on the air here. I can't really give you a visual of this. But just imagine that you think of two different factors when you're thinking of the women who go out and marry. When the husband and wife have a child, a daughter, they say, who is she going to marry? Well, think about what rank that husband, potential spouse has, and where they're located as two important factors. And then looking at it as a historian, you can see how the family is situated in Europe, both socially by rank and geographically by space, where they're marrying. Over the hundreds of years that I was analyzing, I noted that the largest number of Habsburg princesses who married out married into the neighboring Duchy of Bavaria. The Duchy of Bavaria, later Kingdom of Bavaria in the 19th century, was ruled by a very important old dynasty in the empire, the Wittelsbach dynasty, with which the Habsburgs over time had a kind of love-hate relationship. This marriage policy might emphasize the love side of it as opposed to the hate side of it, but that's an open question, I guess, in some of these relationships. 10 of the 66 women who married out in the period under analysis married into Bavarian families. 9 of them married to Hungary, of course, right next door to the Habsburg hereditary holdings in Vienna, a kingdom which is going to become increasingly important for the Habsburgs over time. 8 married into the Kingdom of Bohemia. And in fact, if you include Silesia and Moravia, these are territories that are affiliated with Bohemia normally, you can get that number up to 12. So here you see that the Habsburgs tend to marry right around where their headquarters, where their main bases had become by the early modern period, especially after the accession of Austria, the acquisition of Austria. They're marrying Bavarians, Hungarians, Bohemians. Also, they're marrying into Poland. This was brought up in last class about the big Congress of Vienna, 1515, trying to negotiate marriage alliances with the Polish rulers. Interestingly enough, and this is something which I want to talk a little bit about today, 8 of the 66 women became empress's consort. So that is, they became empresses on their own through being married to an emperor. 5 became queens of Portugal. 4 each went off to be connected to France or the Duchy of Saxony. And 3 then were connected or spent time to Spain and Mantua. So you see a little bit of the expansion of the geographic orientation of the Habsburgs. I can't get into the details of their ranks right now, but in a nutshell, I would say that in the 14th century and into the early 15th century, the ranks of the women, the ranks of the husbands of the Habsburg women was relatively moderate, that is middle-ranking nobility, dukes and the like around the territory of Austria. But once they start rolling in the 16th century and into the 17th century, they're increasingly able to attract marriage partners at the royal level, right? Kings, marrying kings or the heirs to the king, to royal thrones, potential heirs. And when they get to the highest point of their power, say around 1600 or into the 17th century, really the only family that's worth marrying for the Habsburgs is the Habsburgs. And so when they reach the kind of highest point is where you see most of the marriages back and forth between various branches of the Habsburg family. The Habsburg family breaks into a series of branches. The elder branch is the most famous, probably. That's the one based in Spain. The second branch, the cadet branch, is the one based in Vienna and Central Europe. They tend to marry a lot back and forth in the course of the 16th and 17th centuries. From the very beginning of the dynasty, the beginning of the Habsburgs' power in the empire, the Habsburgs used their daughters as important connectors to some of the big power players in the empire. Remember, Rudolf of Habsburg, who was elected the head of the empire in the late 13th century, and his wife, the Countess Gertrude of Hohenberg and Heigerloch, were of relatively modest background. She was actually better placed than he was, though he compensated for that by his election and then by his military successes and some kind of wheeling and dealing and a little bit of brutality thrown in, I would say, with Rudolf. But their daughters, the two of them, Gertrude and Rudolf, were able to use their position and their daughters to create marriage alliances, which then helped the Habsburgs establish themselves as major power players in the empire. Their eldest daughter, Matilda, married one of the princes of Bavaria. That was one of the princes who had an electoral power, one of the guys who could decide who was going to be emperor. Their daughter Agnes married into the Duchy of Saxony. Hedwig married into the Margravate of Brandenburg. Katharina also married into Bavaria. Clementia married out to Hungary and Croatia. Judith married into Bohemia. You can see the power base of the Habsburgs extending, or their connections and family lives extending farther, in this case, in the late 13th, early 14th century. If we jump ahead in history, which we have to because we don't have much time in this broadcast, we'll see that the Habsburgs later used a similar kind of strategy to connect up with their major rival in the West, and that was the House of Valois, the family ruling the French kingdom, and then later the Bourbon family, which was succeeding the Valois as the rulers in the rival kingdom of the French out to the West. In Habsburg history, we have a number of French queens. That is Eleonore in the early 16th century. She died in 1547. Elizabeth, the woman that I wrote the book about, who was Queen of France from 1570 to 1574. The famous Habsburg queen, maybe the second most famous Habsburg queen of France, would be Anna. She was actually the regent of France in the name of her son from 1643 to 1651. And then we have the queen consort of France, Marie Therese, the queen of the consort of the famous Louis XIV of France. I can't complicate this too much for you because this is only a 30-35 minute broadcast or podcast, but you remember, too, you should remember that this story could get even more complicated if you think about the Habsburgs, the women who were Habsburgs not through their father or mother, but maybe only through their mother. For example, the famous Marie de Medici, who was regent of France from 1610 to 1615, her mother was a Habsburg. And strictly speaking, the woman who is most famous in this regard as a Habsburg who goes to France to become queen, that is Maria Antonietta, Marie Antoinette, was only a Habsburg on her mother's side, right? Her father wasn't a Habsburg. This is the beginning of a new dynasty in some ways in the Habsburg lands, the House of Habsburg-Lorraine. But Marie Antoinette was the Queen of France after her husband became king. Husband was Louis. He became king in 1774. They'd been married. She was only 14 and a half maybe when she was sent to France to be married off to the heir to the throne, the Dauphin. She was the 15th of 16 children, of the Emperor Francis I and his consort, Empress Maria Theresa. And unfortunately for Marie Antoinette, of course, the French monarchy was abolished while she was queen in 1792. Her husband was executed in 1793, and her period as Queen Dowager, if you could be a queen dowager when there's no kingdom anymore, was a tragic only 9 month stay, or long 9 month stay, before her execution in 1793. One of the areas of Habsburg history that, or areas of Europe where the Habsburg women had the most influence, besides the role that they played in France, as I said, there were a couple Habsburg regents of France, queen regents there. One of the most important areas was the Low Countries. That is basically now what's the Netherlands, especially what's now Belgium and Luxembourg, and parts of what's now France. There were a lot of Habsburg women who married out, or and you could also say were sent as widows sometimes to be the regents in the Low Countries. There were seven different Habsburg women who were the regents of the Low Countries in between the period 1507 and 1793. So a lot of the time the Habsburgs ruled in the Low Countries, they were ruled by Habsburg women. Sometimes these were women ruling as regents, and sometimes there were women ruling as in their own name. That's actually relatively rare in this occasion. But there was the Infanta Isabella Clara Eugenia, who was sent with her husband Albert to rule there in their own name. That's one of the failures, maybe, of Habsburg foreign policy as a marriage policy, because that independent kingdom, or wasn't a kingdom, but that independent principality failed when Albert and Isabella had no children, and so that reverted back to the Habsburg main line in Spain. Again, in the 1700s, we have a period of joint rule when a Habsburg archduchess, Maria Antoinette's sister, by the way, Maria Christina, went to rule in the Habsburg Netherlands. She was there on and off with her husband Albert, another Albert ruling jointly in the Netherlands, from 1781 to 1793. Though, if you're following along at home, you know that that was a rough time for Habsburgs and for rulers in general, and they were kicked out of the Netherlands a number of times, and eventually settled in Central Europe and never went back. That's when the Habsburgs lost control of the Low Countries. But the Low Countries are another place where Habsburg women married out. The last area that I want to talk about, or the last theme I want to briefly address with you today, is the role of all of these empresses, the Habsburgs who became empresses on their own as being Habsburgs by birth, not only the ones who became empresses by marriage. Marianne Romberg, when she was here, as I mentioned last year, giving a talk, she talked about this woman, Eleonora Magdalena of Pfalz-Neuburg. She was the empress with Leopold I from 1676 to 1705. That's not a good example of the Habsburgs who are marrying in amongst themselves. I would say, when we think about Habsburg empresses, we should remember that there were eight different Habsburg empresses in the period between 1564 to 1765. So what does it mean to marry out of the family if you're marrying another branch of your family? It's a little bit different definition of Habsburgs who left the home to marry abroad. Here we have examples of Habsburgs who leave the home but marry relatives. Right. So starting in 1564, we have the rule of Empress Maria, the consort, Empress consort, and then later important Empress Dowager. She married the Emperor Maximilian II. Of the eight Habsburg Holy Roman Empresses, six of them were married to other Habsburgs. This is a fact that confuses genealogical charts a lot. You have not only Maria of Spain, but then you have Anna of Austria, who is the consort of Matthias. She came from a branch of the family in Tyrol. You have Maria Anna, who was the consort of Ferdinand III. Maria Leopoldina, who was the consort of Ferdinand another consort of Ferdinand III. Margareta Teresa. I'll put all these online for you. Don't remember them all, obviously, just me talking here, but consort of Leopold I, Claudia Felicitas, consort of Leopold I, Maria Amalia, the consort of Charles VII, and then finally, the most famous probably of all the Austrian empresses, that is the consort of Francis I, Maria Theresa, who was actually very influential, not so much in her role as empress, but in her role as the hereditary ruler of the Austrian lands, the hereditary ruler of Bohemia, the hereditary ruler of Hungary. The empress position itself, again, as I said, has been understudied, but it is a place to look to see where Habsburgs married. And you might not think to look there, because when I talked about at the beginning of the presentation today, looking at where the Habsburgs left home, sometimes leaving home didn't require them to go very far, right? If they went just to another branch of the family, if they went from Central Europe to Spain, which I haven't talked about today, but which was something that happened a lot or often, or whether they went from Spain to Central Europe, this was a very characteristic strategy that the Habsburgs employed in their marriage politics. This helps explain how they had influence all over the place, because not only did they have influence in the territories over which they ruled directly, but they also had influence in territories where their sisters or brothers had, where their sisters or mothers or aunts were ruling as well. And I think we nowadays look at a map of Europe so much through these kind of political boundaries that were established, say, in the 20th century after the Second World War, that it's hard for us to imagine a world of Europe where the connections weren't necessarily done over these political boundaries, but were also through these dynastic connections. These dynastic and marital connections are things that are more difficult to kind of conceptualize. As I sit here in my office, I look at a map on the wall of Europe, and it's almost always divided up using political boundaries. But I would suggest, when you think of the marriage strategies of the early modern and medieval Habsburgs, and when you think of people like Maria Antoinette, who left the home for the sake of the House of Austria, the Casa de Austria, it will help you kind of reconceptualize the map, or could help you reconceptualize the map of Europe as not only a set of spaces, but as a set of dynastic connections. It's a world of family ties as much as it is a world of political boundaries, at least in the early modern and medieval, late medieval periods. With that, I think I'll end for today. I hope I didn't confuse you too much with all these names of this Maria and that Maria. The last Holy Roman Empress, just to confuse you a bit to conclude, was also a Maria Theresa. That was Maria Theresa of Bourbon, who had been born in Naples in 1772. She was the consort of the last Holy Roman Emperor, Francis II. And when you think about the marrying out of the family, Maria Theresa is known a little bit for being the last of the Holy Roman Empresses, this Maria Theresa, not her more famous predecessor in the 18th century, earlier in the 18th century. But this Maria Theresa also is famous for having two daughters who also became empresses. So an empress who was the mother of two empresses, because as the 19th century goes on, we start having empires all over the place. There's more and more empires and empresses. But Maria Theresa of Bourbon, the empress consort up until the end of the Holy Roman Empire in 1806, had one daughter who became the empress of the French, Marie Louise, and another daughter who became not only queen consort of Portugal, but the empress consort of Brazil, Maria Leopoldina. But those stories will get us into the 19th century, and today I wanted to concentrate mostly on the medieval and early modern period. If you stick with me and come back next time, we'll be back into the 19th century, because next time I'd like to take you to the fair. I want to take you to the World's Fair in Vienna of 1873. See you then. Bye.